Well, hello, fine football folk. Welcome to the Soccer Central podcast. I'm James Sharman, joined as always on Mondays by John Molinaro. J-Mo, how's it going, pal?
I am fantastic because it's the most wonderful time of the year.
Wow, man, you got some verve today.
Yeah.
I like that. Packed show, as always, today. We'll discuss the Premier League story later in today's show. Also, talk some Champs League with Jared Peters of Sportsnet.ca. Matchday 4. Big games. Teams can qualify for the knockout phase, finally. And we can say farewell to some pretty crappy teams as well. About time. But to start with, it's been a while since I last spoke to Ben Littleton. A long time, in fact, but I'm very happy to have him back on the phone. He is the author of a fantastic new book called 12 Yards, The Art and Psychology of the Perfect Penalty. Ben, welcome to the show, mate. Long time no speak.
Thank you, Ben.
Let me ask you the question then. How much is art and how much is psychology in penalties?
Well, at the beginning of my process, I thought that it was probably 50-50 and technique played a crucial part. But, you know, when you think about it, if you're playing in a national tournament for your country, you are good enough to score a free shot from 12 yards out. So in theory, you should score a penalty every time. That's not always the case. If you're English, it's hardly ever the case. And so by the end of my research, I concluded that I would say about 90% of a penalty is actually psychology.
Ben, maybe you talk a little bit about the motivation behind writing this book. What sort of prompted you to take on this project?
Well, it was the act of following and hoping that England did well at Euro 2012. At that tournament, we lost on penalty shootouts to Italy in the quarterfinal. The shootout was particularly difficult, really, for me to take. We were ahead in the shootout because Italy missed their first one. And yet, we still lost. Significantly, the guy that missed the most important penalty for England was Ashley Cole, who took the last kick, which Buffon saved, so England were out, for the sixth time out of seven penalty shootouts. And the reason it really stuck in my craw was that a month earlier, Ashley Cole had taken a penalty for Chelsea in the Champions League final of 2012 when they beat Bayern Munich on penalties. And so I thought about this player, a player that doesn't take many penalties in his career, and yet when he takes one for Chelsea, he scores. And when he takes one for England, he doesn't score. And I know that's a very small sample, but it wasn't really just about that. It was about his body language, the way he approached the ball. His whole attitude when he was in a Chelsea shirt was totally different to when he was in an England shirt. So I wanted just to see if there was anything in it. If it was just down to luck and a lottery, which is what all coaches say after they lose on penalties, or if there was more to it than that.
So you're saying that Jose Mourinho is a better motivator, for example, or you know, than a Roy Hodgson or even a Capello, you know, for example, because if it's that simple, you know, putting a shirt on, obviously it can't be that simple, can it? Just putting the shirt on, it has to be the leadership group on that field, you know, that leadership group in the room as well. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, there are lots of different aspects at play, really, when you go into a shootout, and no one shootout is the same. I mean, you think about Van Gaal doing the brilliant substitution for Holland against Costa Rica at the World Cup.
Right.
And what he did was send a message to the opposition, we have a specialist goalkeeper that is going to hurt you. Now, never mind that Tim Krul's penalty record was having saved two penalties out of 20 in his career, which is a 90% concession rate and a 10% saving ratio, which is well below the average. Krul was not a penalty expert, and yet by him coming off the bench in that last minute to replace the number one Cillessen, it was enough for the Costa Rican players to think he was an expert. So when it comes down to, you know, the actual kick itself, it's about psychology. What is in your mind at that moment? And, you know, you can do things to help ease the pressure of that moment, and practice is one of them. Now, England coaches always say you can never replicate the pressure of that decisive penalty kick in a World Cup. Now, that is true, but golfers can never replicate the pressure of a putt to win the Ryder Cup, and they practice. Andy Murray had never before had a second serve to win Wimbledon until he actually had one 18 months ago, and he nailed it. So it's about practicing, so that at the point where it becomes the moment of decisiveness, it is almost part of your muscle memory. You know exactly what to do, and you're not really focused on the outcome. You're focused on the process. This is my routine. This is what always works for me. And you're not walking there thinking, I'm going to miss. The whole of the country is going to hate me.
So it's kind of focusing just on the mechanics, and by doing it, sort of you picking it up by rote.
Repetitive.
Yeah, repetitive. It's basically just picking up it through reps.
Correct. Right. I mean, if you're going to boil it down to one or two lessons from it, that is the key one. You can practice it just by reps. So when it comes to that moment, you are in your comfort zone because you are used to it.
I remember reading Johnny Wilkinson's biography. He's a very, very well-known star rugby player for England, won the World Cup with a kick. And he was methodical in his approach to taking kicks, be it, you know, from 50 yards out or 20 yards out in the final of the World Cup or just in practice, the exact same mechanics. And that was, I think, Clive Woodward and his kicking coach got him, you know, in this way to approach every kick. Did you approach Clive Woodward? I know he commented on the book. And found it very fascinating.
I see a lot of similarities with lots of sports, actually. And I think one of football's problems is we're very insular and particularly in England, not keen enough to look for solutions outside of football. Mm-hmm. So I did speak to Sir Clive Woodward, who was coach of that England team in 2003. And I also spoke to Dave Allred, Johnny Wilkinson's kicking coach.
Nice.
And they both told me fascinating things about that moment, which essentially was a fact of repetition. Johnny Wilkinson had practiced this one precise drop goal so many times that when it came down to it, even 10 seconds before the ball came to him, everyone on the bench knew what was going to happen and what the move was going to be, and that Wilkinson would probably do it because his practice was so intense that he would place a ball on the corner flag and try and kick the ball at one post, just one post. And if he was on form, he'd get 8 out of 10.
Wow.
Right, so that is pretty impressive. And so, you know, you have greater margin for error when you're doing a drop goal or a penalty kick, in any sport. I spoke to an American football kicking coach as well because there are obvious similarities with that. You have a specialist kicker whose only job is to kick the ball through the post, and it works. I spoke to a handball goalkeeper and a golfer as well, Ryder Cup golfer Andrew Coulthard, and I think the similarities with golf really are very close, because what I discovered with a lot of players is that even before the kick is taken, you know, you can reduce your chance of scoring with a negative mindset. And a shootout is very different to a normal penalty because, you know, if you're having a normal penalty, A, it's your normal regular taker who would take the penalty, and so he is more likely to score because he's a specialist. Whereas in a shootout, you often get the scenario where non-regular guys are taking penalties. And also in a shootout, you have the walk. And everyone is very scared of the walk because the walk is the walk of doom, the walk, the impending walk of disaster. You know, and guys like Mendieta, who was a penalty specialist, scored 2 penalties in a Champions League final for Valencia, told me that walk is a very intimate and vulnerable moment for a player because essentially you work your whole career to get to a certain level, and suddenly your life's work boils down to this one kick. And I'm not surprised you feel vulnerable. You know, think, we are putting all this pressure on our players. And in club football, it's slightly different. But when you play for your country, a tournament only comes along once every 2 years, a World Cup once every 4 years. There's a huge amount of pressure. And you know that if you miss it, you are going to be remembered. That's going to mark your career and often your whole life beyond your career.
Absolutely, yeah.
And so it is a very precious moment. And we don't really think of it from that point of view. We just expect them to score. But, you know, mentally, if they're not prepared, it is very difficult for them.
Well, I mean, just ask Gareth Southgate, right? A really great career, a really good player, but remembered, sadly, for, you know, missing a very important penalty. I had the chance a few years ago now to face Alan Shearer from the penalty spot. I put the gloves on, and I faced about 10 kicks from him. He just retired. And we all know what Shearer does when he gets in that position. He roofs it, top corner, full power. Now, I'm not a goalkeeper. I didn't get a hand to any of those balls. Now, I don't
probably
care
just
how.
As well, James. Goal net now.
Oh, it was staggering, the power he was delivering those. It was incredible. It really was. I could feel the wind, you know, blow past me. It was just something else. But, you know, I remember thinking then that you know, I don't care who's in goal. It could be Peter Schmeichel. You know, it could be Edwin van der Sar. If he hits it right and goes top corner, full speed, there's no way a goalkeeper in the world will get to that. So whenever I see these guys doing these ridiculous little dipsy-doodle little panenkas and these little roll them in the corner, it does my head in. Now, any stats based on that? Why don't players just roof it top corner over and over?
Oh,
because
I love
that's
it. The dipsy-doodle, famous dipsy-doodle. It's a very good question. There are stats done on this. There are basically two ways of taking penalties if you're going to break it down. One is goalkeeper independent is called, and that's the way that Shearer takes them, right? You absolutely smash it, and you pick your spot, and if you get the right spot, it's unsavable. You're going to score. And yet that's often a high kick, it's kicked high, where there is a margin for error, because as well as kicking it wide of the post, you can kick it over the bar. Mm-hmm. There are two ways you can miss the target. Now, the dipsy-doodle way, as you refer to it, is called the goalkeeper-dependent method. And that is when players wait for the goalkeeper to move and then roll it the other way. And so you think of Eden Hazard, Yaya Toure does it. Balotelli does it, obviously, very well. And over time, the goalkeeper dependent method, so the dipsy-doodle way, is actually more successful.
Really?
Yeah, and it's technically much, much harder because you have to be prepared to change your side at any given moment. You know, I'm thinking of players that also go for the smash, and that's Ricky Lambert, Arturo Vidal. It's brilliant. They're kicking it high, as is David Luiz. You know, these guys, they're dramatic, and they're exciting to watch. But they also have this margin for error, so they are more likely to miss.
We're talking to Ben Littleton here on the Soccer Central podcast. Not to bring up a sore subject for you and James, but I think it's Euro 96, the last time England won a penalty shootout at senior team level.
Spain.
Do you have a theory, Ben, as to why England struggles at senior team level when it comes to penalty shootouts?
Yeah, well, how long have you got? The numbers do show that if your team lost its last shootout, it is more likely to lose its next shootout.
Really?
The penalty records go down quite considerably. If your team lost its last two shootouts, your chances of scoring a penalty in the next shootout go down to 59% from about 76%.
Wow.
And that's regardless of whether you were playing in that game or even took a penalty in that game. It's because there is a vicious cycle, a vicious circle, if you like, of defeat. So the more you lose, the more you lose. Now, that's one problem that England had, and they have been very unlucky, not in losing penalties, but in the opponents they faced, because the first shootout was against West Germany. Okay, these things happened in 1990 in the semi-final. We lost. Then we beat Spain, and everything was hunky-dory. Penalties are no longer an issue for us. And we lost to Germany again in 96 on home soil in a match that was surrounded by military metaphors, given the opponents and the history. And then 2 years later, in 1998, we lost on penalties to Argentina. Now, my theory from doing all this research was that losing to Argentina was incredibly hurtful to England because it brought back the same traumatic memories as losing to Germany, another country with whom we've had a complicated political, geographical history. We'd fought over the Falklands. It became a war for us. Penalty shootouts became a war, and we kept on losing them to old political rivals. Now, if England had lost a penalty shootout to Greece or to Switzerland or even to France, to a country that it wasn't quite so powerful a connection in terms of its history, I don't think the associations would be quite so traumatic for us and for our identity. So that's one of the problems that I think England have had. They associate it with this great loss, and that's made it harder. And there are things that England players have done in their penalty shootouts that you can correlate to their failures. And one is a very simple one, and that's simply rushing their kicks. Now, I spoke to a researcher who timed the reaction time from the referee blowing his whistle to denote you could start your run-up. to the players actually starting their run-up. And England players had the quickest reaction times by far.
Wow.
Their reaction time was 0.28 seconds on average. And to put that into context, Usain Bolt's reaction time is 0.17 seconds.
Jeez.
Well, they were crapping themselves.
England players were seeing the referee's whistle as a get set go, on your marks get set go, and on go they go. And a penalty, the referee's whistle, is to say you can kick the ball when you're ready. You look at other players and you look at the whistle, you hear the whistle and you watch them, they'll take a deep breath, they'll wait 1 or 2 seconds. It's only 1 or 2 seconds, but they're kicking it on their terms when they're ready. They're not rushing and they don't want to get it out of the way because they don't see it as a chore, as a trauma. They see it as an opportunity to be a hero. And that's one thing that England players clearly don't do.
Interesting. Ben, like me, I wonder, do you grit your teeth and do you bang your head on the table when you hear match commentators describe it as a lottery?
I hate it. It's my worst thing.
Me too.
But it's something that propagated by the coaches as well. Because just to take you back to Van Gaal again at the World Cup, he was, you know, everyone praised him after the Tim Krul substitution, and he, you know, milked it for all it was worth. Yeah, well, we thought we'd do something different. We had it in our mind, you know, etc. And he was very happy to take all the credit. And then Holland played Argentina in the semi-final and lost on penalties. Now, on that occasion, Van Gaal really did cock it up because Van Persie was not fit before the game and therefore very unlikely to last 120 minutes. He started the match, and when it got to penalties, Van Gaal didn't have a solution to who should replace Van Persie to take the first penalty, and he actually publicly balled out his players and said, well, I asked two players to take penalties. They refused. Now, if he was this great, thoughtful coach that had pre-planned the cruel substitution, he would surely have worked out who should take a penalty in case Van Persie is not going to last the match. And at the end of the Argentina shootout, when Holland lost, he reverted to type. And he said, well, you know, penalty shootouts, they're just a lottery. even the guy that masterminded the greatest penalty shootout in World Cup history is then admitting that it's just down to luck himself. When he loses, it's a lottery. When you win, obviously you're the genius.
I still remember covering Copa America in 2011, I think it was, in the quarter or semi-finals. Brazil missed all five kicks. It was just staggering.
Yeah, that has happened. That was not a good moment for them, was it?
It wasn't. It got worse, though. It would get worse. Let me ask you this. So, Ben, you're on Football Manager, all right? You've built your team. It's the Champions League final. You've got your goalkeeper. You've got your takers. Who in the world, past or present, are you putting in goal? And who are you putting to score and take that final penalty?
Oh, that's such a brilliant question. I would go for Mikel Landreau, a French goalkeeper who has played over 600 times in the French league, and actually saved a penalty on his debut when he was 17 years old.
Wow.
And ever since that moment, he became a penalty expert. And you may argue that it was a bit of fortune that made him save that first penalty, but because of that, everyone was really scared of him from the spot. So they faced and thought, this guy's a penalty expert. You know, I need to go for the furthest corner, the inside of the side netting, because otherwise he's going to stop it. And because of that, and therefore the margin for error became reduced, lots of players missed the target against him, and his penalty record became really, really good. It almost became a self-fulfilling prophecy. They thought he was a penalty specialist, so he became a penalty specialist. And it got to the point where he was playing for Nantes in a League Cup match against PSG when Ronaldinho was playing for Paris. It was in 2002, and there was a last-minute penalty awarded. And Landreau took his place right next to the post on one side. I mean, he was really, you know, playing silly buggers with Ronaldinho, really playing mind games. And Ronaldinho didn't quite know where to go. He had almost a whole goal to aim for on one side, or Landreau right next to the post. What did Ronaldinho do? He was convinced that Landreau would run across the goal to the empty side, so he rolled the ball towards the post where Landreau was standing, and Landreau stayed still. I mean, if that is not brilliant mind games, I don't know what it is.
Oh, yeah.
So he's my goalkeeper. he's my goalkeeper, and we'll tell everyone his story, so any opponent would be very nervous about facing him. And then in terms of who would take the penalty, I'd think about Zidane, who always took it in the same corner but struck it so well. It was very difficult to stop, apart from his penalty in the World Cup final, when he went for a Panenka against Buffon, his old teammate, and scored it. So he would be great. I think about Panenka as well. He'd be in my squad of five. But I'd go for Mendieta.
Really?
The only player to score a penalty in a World Cup, a European Championship, and two in a Champions League final. The guy had veins of ice. He was so cool. And he once took a penalty against Casillas, who was his former teammate, and a guy they trained together in the Spain national side. And Mendieta did not even look at the ball when he struck the penalty. He was just watching Casillas' eyes. And Casillas was saying, well, I'm just going to look at his body shape, where he was looking, and I was convinced that I was going to save it. And Casillas said afterwards, I don't know how that guy did it, but he just didn't take his eyes off me the whole time. He just stared me down, and he scored. And so for that reason, Mendieta would be my guy.
Amazing.
Ben, when I think of, famous penalties, over time, I mean, for me, probably my favorite was Francesco Totti's Cucaio against Holland in the Euro 2000 semis. Just such an audacious sort of attempt at a key moment in the game. When you look back, in writing this book, did you have sort of favorites that you thought of and said, wow, yeah, that really was a special moment?
Well, yeah, the Panenka one was obviously one of them, simply because he was the first guy to do it. And it was in 1976,
right,
the final penalty of the European Championship final against West Germany. And the background is interesting. I mean, he practiced it for 2 years earlier, just for this one moment. But he's playing for essentially a communist in a communist country, where spontaneity and this kind of impudence is very alien. And the risk that was involved in taking that penalty was huge. I mean, he told me that had he missed, I said, what would have been the consequences for you if you had missed? And he said that afterwards he'd been speaking, he'd asked that exact question to someone very high up in government, and he said, you know, he would have been sent to the mines for the rest of his life.
Now that's pressure.
It almost became a life or death moment, because, you know, what became this great symbol and icon for a player and for a team was such a dangerous thing to do that, we don't think of the risk factor now, but there's a reason why no England player has attempted a Panenka in a shootout, because if you do miss it, you look ridiculous.
There's a few guys who wouldn't mind going down the mines after a shootout in England uniform.
Come on.
Well, that's true. That's true. They'd probably quite appreciate the break from the media hassle.
Yeah. Far worse, right? Far worse. Listen, Ben, thanks so much, mate. That was great. Now, our listeners can get the book on Amazon, I'm assuming?
Yes, that's right. Yeah, it is available on Amazon. That's correct.
The book is called 12 Yards, The Art and Psychology of the Perfect Penalty by Ben Littleton. Ben, brilliant job, mate. Thank you so much. Great to chat again.
Thanks, James. Cheers, John.
Cheers.
Fantastic. Fascinating. That was fascinating, wasn't it? You can follow Ben, by the way, at Ben Light, BenLyt, on Twitter. Just outstanding. It's funny, because Italy, J-Mo.
Yes.
Haven't got the best history in shootouts either.
No.
Right?
No.
Now, it's nothing quite as bad as England, but it's pretty poor.
No, although they did win a World Cup on
that
a shootout.
Probably overshadows it.
Yeah.
They also lost one, too.
They did, yeah. Maybe the most famous mess. I mean, Roberto Baggio in 94, very famous.
Over the bar by about 3,000 miles.
Yeah.
Yeah, incredible. But that's a great chat and really good book. So please, I ask you, give it a whirl. Everyone out there, get on Amazon, buy it. It's quite brilliant. Before we get to our next guest, Premier League weekend. Big derby. Man City beating United 1-0.
Right.
Could have been 3 or 4. Michael Oliver had a terrible game.
He did.
With the whistle. Just terrible. I thought 3 blatant penalties. But in the end, City get it back, and it wasn't a vintage performance, but they look far better than they had done in recent weeks, I thought. Yaya Toure, slowly but surely, maybe finding his form. But the fact that United are saying, yeah, well, we played pretty well. You know, Van Gaal saying, we'll take something from this. That speaks to me volumes about where this club is at right now.
Well, and it's interesting because I actually wrote about this for sportsnet.ca. I think potentially this might be a turning point for United. And I know that sounds crazy, but you think about it. They had a makeshift back line to begin with, and then they lose Rojo, and then they lose Smalling.
That's a good thing, isn't it? Losing Rojo.
That's another.
Dreadful.
That's another podcast entirely. And then Smalling picks up those two, I mean, utterly ridiculous yellow cards. I'm not sure what he was thinking. And sure, you know, City probably should have had two or three penalties go their way. But I mean, all in all, I thought United handled themselves pretty well after that. I mean, they were, you know, pretty tight. City was swarming all over them in the start of the second half. And then for the final 20 minutes, I thought United actually carried the play. So there's no question that they've got defensive issues that they have to sort out, especially, you know, when the transfer window opens up again in January. But I wonder if there's something that they might be able to take something from this and say, look, we know we've got issues, obviously, but, you know, mm-hmm. we were able to hold City to one goal at home, like at the Etihad Stadium. Maybe there's something to build on this. So we'll see.
Yeah, perhaps. Or they'll just, you know, once again, fall into that malaise with this makeshift back line.
It was
Carrick and the kid playing at centre-half. Valencia on the right side. Luke Shaw's not there yet.
No.
On the left-hand side. You know? So there's still many, many issues. When I saw Joe Hart run out and confront Mike Oliver, the referee, I thought he headbutted him at first. Right? Now,
it looked like it.
It did, didn't it? But regardless, that behavior by itself I found just disgusting. And you see it more and more now. How he didn't get a card for that.
Yeah, right? Absurd.
I mean, forget, he may not have headbutted him, but he was that close in the guy's face. That should be a red card.
Absolutely.
Simple as that.
It's a form of dissent, as far as I'm concerned.
Absolutely it is. It is. Still, three big points for City, who keep in the hunt, I suppose, for the title. But let's be honest, I don't think Chelsea's going anywhere right now. Other results are of note. Southampton won again. They've won 10 now of 11 overall, beating Hull 1-0. Now, it's been a relatively easy schedule. It's going to get a lot harder pretty soon. I think as of November 30th, they play City, and then 7 of the next 9 games are against top 7 teams.
Wow.
So far, it's been a very easy schedule, taking nothing away from them. But boy, it's going to be a test.
Well, we've been saying for weeks now that, you know, eventually that this isn't going to last, right? That they're going to drop. Mm-hmm. So it'll be interesting to see how they fare during this stretch, because as you said, they've got several tough games. So this will be a real test of where they truly stand.
I think they have Leicester and Villa before then, so it could be 6 more points.
Well,
in the
6
bag.
More points then.
But then I think it's City, Arsenal and Chelsea or something, you know, in 3 or 4 weeks. So
that's tough.
We'll see. You know, it's going to be interesting. Other results, Spurs beat Villa 2-1. Benteke's red card, harsh.
No, I don't think you can put your hand up to a player like that.
I'm
know.
With you.
I mean, the Spurs, who was it that he touched on Spurs? I can't even remember.
I forget now.
He didn't go down or anything like that, and he didn't really sell it. But I mean, and so it wasn't, I think, if there was any sort of physical pain or damage that he did. But you just can't do that. It's a silly, silly foul, and you're asking for it.
There's a lot of commentary post match saying how ridiculous it was. It was harsh. But I'm with you as well. The fact is, it's a black and white rule, right?
Yeah.
If you raise your hand to a player, to
you
another
can't
player's
do it.
Throat or face, it's a red card. As simple as that. It was stupid. But I understand why it's frustrating. It had been fouled mercilessly the previous 30 seconds.
Right. Oh, absolutely.
No, but still, you know, you can't really argue about that. Newcastle won again. Again, beating Liverpool 1-0. It's 4 straight wins now for the Magpies. And it's funny how times change, you know. Brendan Rodgers is now being called out by everyone. And Alan Pardew's been celebrated by everyone. Man, it's a fickle business.
Fickle business. I was going to say, man, it's fickle. What did you make of the newspaper report? I think where Gerard was saying, yeah, you know, I'd like to stay, but he was, you know, talking about his future and how he might not be back at Liverpool. He's 34, I think.
Yeah.
Do you bring him back?
I bring him back, but it's got to at some point be in a reduced role. I think he's playing too much right now. He has not played well.
And that would be my criticism, is that they're still trying to accommodate him, even though tactically I don't think it's possible. And if you do bring him back, I mean, is he the kind of guy who's going to want to take a reduced role at Liverpool?
Well, I mean, he says he can play at least 2 or 3 more years, right? It reminds me a bit of the Frank Lampard situation. In that the 2 or 3 years prior to Lampard leaving Chelsea, he was saying, you know, I want to stay, you know, but the Chelsea policy was we're only going to sign one-year
deals.
And it will be a reduced role. And it was a reduced role for him over the last couple of years. And then he eventually left.
Can he take a reduced role at Liverpool?
Yeah. He says a great quote last week. They're saying, you know, before the first Real Madrid match, you know, do you regret not going to Real? Because at one point, Real really wanted him.
Right.
And he goes, you know, one day I might regret not going there, but not as much as I would have regretted leaving Liverpool. Right? He's a red through and through. So maybe if he goes somewhere, it'll be to a different country.
Does he go to MLS?
Yeah, possibly. possibly. I mean, I have no idea, but I can see that more so than, yeah, than a Premier League team.
It's interesting because I think, like, I was counting the hours when I first saw the report in the paper about him, you know, talking about his future, and I think it was about 7 hours later being linked to, like, the Galaxy and the Red Bulls and New York City FC.
Everyone,
so
yeah,
it was,
yeah,
just unbelievable.
I mean, I just don't think he would, after shunning Chelsea at the 12th hour when he, you know, a few, right, years ago now, why he would then leave for another Premier League club now. You know, he left for the reasons, his family pressure.
Right.
He beloved Liverpool club. Why leave now just for like a year or two and play a reduced role? If you're leaving for Man City or Chelsea, it's a reduced role there as well.
Sure, absolutely.
Right? You're not, yeah, going to be a starting, you know, midfielder. So I think he'll resign, and I think right now it's just a bit of contract leverage he's looking for. The club, like, the club will decide if I come back or not, and well, that's true, right?
Right.
They'll offer him a deal, he can accept it or not, but they've got to offer him a deal first.
It's an interesting one, and yeah, I think you take into consideration what the fans want too, because he's such an icon there and such a legend.
Yep.
And would they accept him? No. Taking a reduced role.
A reduced role, yeah. I think they're smart enough.
Yeah.
And I think if they're watching this year, the team's struggling on many levels, and one of them is Steven Gerrard.
But
right?
I wonder how much they recognize that, though. I think they're just...
Well, there's always going to be those one-eyed blinkered fans who will never be able to, you know, say goodbye to a great player, ever. You know? There's still players who are upset at Man United for letting Roy Keane go. You know?
Right.
It always happens. So I think if he stays... they'll be happy and they'll accept the reduced role if it happens. If there's someone coming in that can replace him. You know, Jordan,
right,
Henderson seems to be fit for that role at some point.
Yeah.
I don't know. If he leaves now, who's going to sit in the... Emre Can? Probably not quite yet.
No.
You know? So,
no.
Who knows? I don't know. Well, let's switch gears now and talk some Champions League with Sportsnet.ca's Jared Peters. Jared, how you doing, mate?
I'm well. How are you guys?
Excellent, thanks. So, we're just discussing Liverpool, of course, up against Real Madrid this week in a really big game for them, but let's be honest, no one expects them to win this thing. We were talking about Steven Gerrard, and I was mentioning that of all the issues this season, there's numerous with this club. Gerrard's form and play is very, very high on my list of issues as far as when will he see a reduced role. Entering this one, do you agree with that, or do you think Gerrard's still got enough to offer?
I don't know if it's that the question of does he have enough to offer. He has to have enough to offer, because I don't know what other options Brendan Rodgers has in that role at the moment. Last year, actually, there were times where I felt, especially during the middle of the season, that Gerrard was playing quite well. The amount of possession Liverpool had and the way that they built from the back meant that he touched the ball a lot, maybe more than he had in his career previously. And what that meant was the sheer amount of his touches limited the amount that he was actually moving and getting forward. And it kind of negated for me a lot of the mistakes that he had been making previously in his career, a lot of the high-profile mistakes we ended up seeing from him later in the season. At this point, I can't imagine Gerrard coming out of this team. He's an untouchable. Whether that's right or wrong is up for argument. But he's playing against a team that in Real Madrid that have so much through their history have a history of untouchable players. Iker Casillas is one. When his form dips, he is still in the team. I just don't see a way that Liverpool will go into this matchup through the rest of the season without having Gerrard in a prominent role.
Bayern hosts Roma on Wednesday, this 2 weeks after the Germans, totally trashed the Gelarossi 7-1 at Stadio Olimpico. What did you make of that performance for Bayern, and can the Italians kind of rebound from that, you know, that sort of shocking loss and their lackluster domestic form?
I think Bayern and Real Madrid are simply playing on another level right now. They're certainly my two favorites to go the distance in this competition. With Roma now going away to Bayern, who are coming off a really tight and emotional win over Borussia Dortmund, I think that's a really, really tough assignment. If they can keep it close, I think that would be sort of a moral victory for them. I really believe that the confidence in this Roma team took a hit in that Bayern Munich game. Rudy Garcia had done so many good things since coming into the team last season, and the resurgence of Totti and the good story that Totti has been this season, becoming the oldest Champions League goal scorer in Manchester City previously, had a lot of good feeling going around this team, and I think that really really took a hit in the Bayern Munich game. They're still in a good position in the group, simply because Manchester City have been struggling so much. If they could somehow nick a draw in Bavaria, that would be a massive result. But I think if, you know, they'll take their lumps now and look to their final two match days to see what they can get from this bracket, because I can't see them winning in this match day.
It'll be fascinating seeing some of these teams like Bayern Munich, like Real Madrid, teams on the brink of advancing, you know, in match day four. Do they take their foot off the pedal, so to speak? Do they, you know, rest some players now because they're going to qualify at some point? Or do they just try and get it all done now, in the bag, let's qualify, and then, you know, take the next two match days to relax? So I think it should be fascinating. You mentioned City against CSKA Moscow. We saw them win the derby on the weekend. Not a complete performance, but slow, certainly better than we've seen City in recent weeks. Listen, that is a great group, isn't it? Right now it's Bayern on 9 points, Roma on 4, Man City on 2, and CSKA Moscow on 1. That being said, from what you saw in the last match against CSKA Moscow, this team has the ability to steal some points. What do you think the mindset for Pellegrini is going into this one?
To keep playing until the final whistle.
Yeah, good point.
On match day 3, they should have had that game put to bed early in the first half. They looked really, really good, and I thought going into the break, a big win away to Moscow, how that's going to lift this team, that's just going to be fantastic. Moscow put Dumbia on at the restart, and we again really saw Ahmed Musa, who had a really good World Cup for Nigeria and who I followed since the under-20 age category, really start to tear the Man City fullbacks a new one in that game. For some reason, then, the substitutions for Pellegrini after the restart were really, really negative, and they simply got caught out trying to close down a European match away from home against a side that scored once and all of a sudden sniffed around that they could get something from this game, and they did. City then went on to lose to Newcastle in the League Cup, and that was a really, really strong team that they put out there. So you really can't underestimate how massive yesterday's derby win for them was. Even though it was a little bit messy at times, they absolutely needed that. Just touching back to something you said, James, about teams starting to maybe rotate a little bit if they're on the cusp of getting through, like Real Madrid. I think we often see them wait, usually try to get the business done and wait till the end of November, December to start doing that. But as Ancelotti has already said, you know, a squad rotation for Real Madrid at this point going into match day 4 involves the insertion of Gareth Bale. you know, what is that to Real Madrid? So Liverpool really, really have a tough assignment.
We're talking to Jared Peters here on the Soccer Central podcast. Shakhtar Donetsk, who hosts Bate Borisov, is on the verge of qualifying for the round of 16. You have an interesting article that went up today on Sportsnet.ca detailing how Donetsk has made this, you know, pretty formidable run in the Champions League, and it's even more incredible when you consider what's going on politically in the Ukraine. How do you account for Donetsk's relative success this season?
That's a good question. They actually started the season off really, really well. I don't put that down to anything else. That I think everyone in Ukraine was a little bit caught aback at what went on. Obviously, we had three Crimea-based teams that were taken out of the first division at the last minute. So we all of a sudden had a contracted league starting, and everyone was kind of starting from the same spot with all the uncertainty that was going on. Shakhtar, by no means the team that was temporarily relocated. There are several of them from the Donetsk and the Luhansk regions, which are both the breakaway regions that had their controversial elections yesterday. Donetsk has been playing most of their matches in Lviv, where they've been able to... They got 33,000 for one Champions League game and 18,000 for another one. And other than that, they've been averaging maybe 8,000 or 9,000 and the match. They've been training in Kiev. I wrote in the article, and people who have been following the situation will know, that the Brazilian contingent at Donetsk, and there's been a formidable Brazilian contingent going back half a decade or more, that's simply one of the transfer strategies at their club, were really, really uncertain about going back to Donetsk to start the season, as you can imagine. But the team has been put up in a comfortable cushy hotel in Kiev. They've tried to make things as comfortable for the players as possible. obviously it's not ideal to travel then 6 hours west to Lviv for matches, but I often think even the Champions League and the familiar surroundings of just playing European football, even playing away from home in European football, offers this Shakhtar team as much of kind of a sense of home as they're going to get this season. Then, of course, another conversation entirely is the sheer amount of quality in this squad. I think Luis Adriano should have been called up to the Brazilian squad a long, long time ago. Mm-hmm. He gives them that option at center forward that Luis Felipe Scolari simply didn't seem to really hit on anything there and kept going back to Fergie and Joe. And now they have a legitimate option in Luis Adriano. I think often when Shakhtar and some Eastern European clubs buy Brazilian players at a very, very young age, they kind of go off the radar a little bit in their home country and with the international setup, and that's to the detriment of the Brazil team. Douglas Costa is going to be playing in upcoming friendlies against Austria and Turkey, and Elis Teixeira, for me, should be on the list to be recalled very, very soon. I watched him coming up through the ranks as an under-20 player, and I rate him very, very highly. They have more Brazilian players on this team than Ukrainian players. They play attractive football, and if the players are comfortable, if they're happy, they're going to be delivering on the field, and they've done that so far.
I mean, it's funny, even after, in the end, a very dreadful, well, disappointing World Cup for Brazil, they're still the biggest exporters of talent around the world, aren't they? It's just amazing. In Group F, we have PSG on 7 points, a point up in Barcelona. Ajax and Apoel are languishing, 2 and 1 point, respectively. Barca take on Ajax. And I guess since Barca lost to PSG, they've kind of fallen into this malaise of late. Now, I know Suarez is back, but since he's come back, they haven't won in two games, lost two straight games in the league now. Is it just a little blip, do you think, or will we see the real Barcelona, you know, emerge in this match day?
I'm not sure what the real Barcelona is anymore.
Yeah, good point.
I'm glad you pointed out the Paris Saint-Germain game, because when they lost 3-2 in that game, Rakitic has only started once since, and that was this past weekend against Celta Vigo, and he was appalling. He was very, very poor. I think that's caught a lot of people off guard, just how much he has underachieved so far this season. You brought Suarez up, and rightfully so. The thing is, in the two matches that he started, he played the full 90 minutes against Celta. He's almost looked as sharp as Neymar and Lionel Messi have in those games. He hasn't looked off the pace. His crossing and his passes have been crisp. I'm not sure he exactly is comfortable with where he's being played, which is usually on the right, occasionally drifting to the left. Lionel Messi seemed as confused as anyone. There were times in that game against Celta Vigo where I noticed him dropping right back alongside Busquets, right in front of the Barcelona defense, to pick up the ball by himself, bring it downfield by himself, and try to build up by himself. And for me, what that tells me is he misses vintage Xavi Hernandez and vintage Andres Iniesta, and you simply do not replace two players like that. People can talk about rebuilding Barcelona, bringing in Rakitic, bringing in Rafinha, who I think is a terrific player and probably will earn a senior Brazil tattoo, and bringing in Halilovic to the Barcelona B squad. But Iniesta and Xavi were two of the finest midfield maestros of their generation, who just happened to play on the same team. While Lionel Messi was there and starting off in his prime. You don't replace that. Barcelona will not be the same team that they were in the last decade, simply because of the decline of those two players. They simply have to find a new way to score goals, a new way to run the midfield, and that so far is something that Luis Enrique has really been struggling with. No,
go ahead. Finish your point.
The fans have been struggling as well. They came off the booze against Celta Vigo in the weekend. Everyone's uncomfortable with this.
Right. What about Juventus, Jared? Because I think going into this Champions League campaign, myself included, I think a lot of us thought that they were going to finally get this right after, you know, a lackluster campaign last year. And here they are. They're coming off that loss in Greece against Olympiacos. They have to host Olympiacos in Turin, and Max Allegri has made no bones about it, saying this is a mandatory win. How do you account for their sort of uneven form? I mean, fabulous in Serie A, but underperforming in Europe.
There's some similarities with the way Manchester City also do well domestically the last few seasons and struggle in Europe. In Juve's last game, so much of it has to be chopped up to the goalkeeper, to Roberto. He was sensational in that game.
Yeah, he was, absolutely.
He was my star goalkeeper of that match day. There's not much else you can do when a goalkeeper's standing on his head like that.
Right.
Of course, you do try to break him down. Try to create chances from different areas, not the same route all the time, not from the same wide areas all the time. Again, you have to account for a decline of a certain Andrea Pirlo.
Yeah.
Although I would sometimes think that the Champions League would suit him a little bit more than Serie A, but that hasn't been the case so far this season. I still do see them getting through this group, to be honest. Their match on December 9th at home to Atletico Madrid will probably decide who goes through, who can go through in one of the two spots. Olympiacos still has 6 points as well, which is three more than Juventus. But I don't think Juve are... It's definitely not over for them. They're away to Malmo in November. They should win that. Of course, we say they should. I think it comes down to December 9th at home to Atletico. For them, Atletico by no means have been impressing in the Champions League this year either.
Right. Well, you're far more optimistic than I am, Jared. So I thank you for that. Listen, thanks so much for joining us, mate. We really appreciate it, and we'll talk soon.
Cheers, guys.
Thanks, Jared.
That's Jared Peters, longtime contributor for Sportsnet.ca. That's it for this show, but just a reminder that the UEFA Champions League resumes this week, as we've been talking about in all this podcast, and you can watch all 16 matches on various Sportsnet platforms on Tuesday and Wednesday, including Real Madrid versus Liverpool and Bayern Munich versus Roma. And on Thursday, Sportsnet's going to be airing 9 UEFA Europa League games on its many platforms. For a full rundown of games, we'll be showing, go to Sportsnet.ca and check out the broadcast schedule. And James Sharman, Thomas Dobby, and Brendan Dunlop will return on Thursday to host another edition of the Soccer Central podcast, although clearly not as good as this one.
No Dunlop, actually, this week.
No Dunlop this week.
You want to step in?
Possibly. Yeah. I might have to step in then. Cool. Well, then that's...
So it's going to be better.
That podcast just instantly got better. Thanks so much for joining us this week. Until next week, cheers for listening.
Bye.